Well, hey, folks, here we are for our culture segment of the show, and I get the privilege of introducing you to someone that you may already know, at least through print. His name is Scott Stanley. He has been a contributor to Boundless before. Just jump onto our site and Google, well, not Google, whatever, search for his name within our site, and you will see what he has written for us. But Scott is the co-director of the Center for Marital and Family Studies right here in our own state at the University of Denver, and has published a ton, most importantly, the work on Boundless, of course. But he is also the author of a number of books, including A Lasting Promise, which is one he talked about. He's actually here on campus in the studio with me and spoke this morning to our staff regarding a lot of the findings, the research that he does. You know our own Glenn Stanton here at Focus. He brings these folks through, so we utilize him for all his connections and have fun doing that. But Scott, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Very good to have you. And while you are listening, you can jump onto Scott's blog, which is Sliding Versus Deciding, and that's versus VS, slidingvsdeciding.com. And you'll see just basically what he's talking about on a number of different fronts. So, but we're going to talk a little bit today about this concept of sliding versus deciding. He's written about it a bit for Boundless. And of course, we talk about it at Boundless a lot because we're seeing it as being so common among daters, young adult daters, even those, sorry folks, within the Christian realm. So however that plays out for you, you know you've been there. I know I've been there. I know that I have a few relationships littering my past that were super lame as a result of poor decision making. So we're going to hopefully get some great insights here from Scott. So Scott, I want to start out. Now, you obviously are the king of research and culling together trends and what that looks like. I want to start by, you shared a quote when you talked to us this morning. You said, commitment is making a choice to give up other choices. And that's from your book, The Power of Commitment. And I think like when people look at that, they say, yeah, you know, that makes sense. So if commitment is truly making a choice, you're going to give up other choices. Why is that in our culture today such a hard thing to actually apply to one's life? I mean, I think we have a generation here that just wants all the choices in the world and wants them to remain our choices.
Yeah, I think we are encouraged culturally, marketing messages, pretty thoroughly up and down the culture, to hang on to everything, to hang on to every option. And if you think about it, whenever you're really making a commitment, you're choosing some path over another path, you're choosing one product over another, and you're choosing a mate, you're making a choice to give up other choices. And that's what commitment is. It's I'm deciding this is the way I'm going, this is what I'm choosing, and I'm going to let the other options go. So given that we have a culture that really encourages not to let anything go, not to give up any options, I think it's harder than ever for people to make really crisp and clear commitments in their lives, and maybe especially in their romantic lives.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting because it seems like no one is pressuring them to make commitments either. You know, everyone's allowing them to keep all their options open in whether it's the workplace. Well, you want to do this and do that, just, you know, freelance a little bit on the side, or maybe try this job for a few months and then move on to something else. I mean, it seems to be kind of...
That's one of the greatest changes that a lot of young people today wouldn't maybe even recognize this because they didn't live through the history. But if you look at what's happened in the last 30, 40 years in our culture and in most Western and most industrialized nations, you can see the steady dismantling of kind of a framework or steps or stages for how people did relationships. So when I was younger, it was very common, even in high school, for people to go steady. I mean, you date somebody for a while and then you would decide, and it was very well understood what it meant, whether you're going to go steady or not, which was a public emblem of how committed you were. Mm-hmm. Most of those things are rapidly disappearing from the culture. And those things required clarity. Those things really pushed for decisions, even at, you know, levels well short of marriage. And now we see a great preference for ambiguity and not having to give up any options.
Okay. Well, when Glenn introduced you to us this morning, and of course we feel at Boundless, you know, that we already had an inside scoop as to who you are, but he talked about you as one of the experts out there right now on cohabitation. And we're going to talk about this in a bit, about how sadly we're seeing a lot of Christians cohabit, just not maybe in equal numbers to the world at large, but certainly I'm finding experientially that many are, because they think it's their only option and they're test driving potential spouses and all kinds of stuff. But you talk about the slide into cohabiting, and you discuss it as being, you know, a decision, quote, decision that's made with no planned discussion of it actually happening. Can you kind of paint a picture for us of what that looks like? Like, why is it just the assumption that to be normal and cool, you have to cohabit because, well, you know, we're just doing it and you have to learn some things or whatever. But what is the thought process for men and or women, if they are different, in how this decision is made?
Yeah, let's talk about the value or the belief and then the process real quickly. So certainly in terms of value and belief, and it's been this way for a long time, and Christians are not immune from this, it may really be the number one thing, the highest ranking thing that the average person believes will give them a leg up in marriage is living together first, which includes that idea of testing. And remind me if you will to come back to the testing idea for a second. But so that belief is really strong. Process-wise, what it looks like, what sliding looks like, is somebody's over at another person's place a couple nights a week, and then maybe several nights a week, and then they start to have, you know, like a section in the closet and maybe a drawer, and gradually there's more stuff over there. And then maybe the other person's lease is up, or roommates kick them out, or something happens, you know, where a lot of couples don't actually make a decision about it. They find themselves cohabiting by a process of sliding. You know, all of a sudden here, this is where we both live, and neither of us has another place to go live, and it just sort of happened, and we didn't talk about it or decide. And it's kind of, one way I like to say it is, it's a transition without a decision.
Okay. That is interesting. And what I think is, let's turn the corner a little bit to talk about then what this looks like for Christian young adults, because you actually talked about a number of indicators for cohabitation. You talked about, you know, folks being less religious, having more conflict, from divorced homes, a more favorable view of divorce. What in the world does that mean for Christians then? Because most Christians would not fall within those indicators, and yet we're seeing Christians cohabit. Why the disconnect?
Yeah, I think I think two things are true at the same time. One is that if you have a group in like the studies we do that hasn't cohabited before marriage, they're going to be, on average, much more traditionally religious than the rest of the sample. And so that's just what you expect, and that's what you just said. But the other thing that's true at the same time is that Christians swim in the same culture as non-Christians, and we're all affected by these messages. We're all affected, for example, by this idea that it's a good idea to test the relationship by living together before marriage. Turns out in our research, that's actually the single worst answer you can give about why you're living together. And we think what that means is that if you feel like you need to test something, you probably already know something you should be acting on in terms of maybe moving on from the relationship.
Mm-hmm. Which is interesting, because I mean, and I totally agree with that, because one of the problems I see, especially as young adults are protracting their singleness, getting married later and later, is that if you look at our parents' or grandparents' generation, it was a lot easier to marry for, I mean, I'm just saying this totally, making a generalization, but you could marry like normal people. But now people are marrying people, and they're marrying crazy people.
Yeah.
And you're meeting people online, and you don't know what their deal is. And they're bringing baggage into the relationship, and they're, which is why I think Christians are justifying this idea of test driving, because they're like, I want to marry this great person that's going to lead our family and that's going to, but the people they're meeting are people with all kinds of compromise in their life, and, you know, pseudo Christians. Well, I'm a Christian because I grew up in America and all that, you know, and it's, that is very ambiguous, it seems. And so I don't know if you've seen that in the research or any trends related to, there's not a hard and fast line anymore of definition.
Yeah, Lisa, I think that's a really great insight, that some of the increased motivation to test is based in this very thing about there being so much ambiguity. So mm-hmm. people know they don't know as much. They're not in a community as much. They're not as connected. I don't know your family, don't know your history. And those things would have used to have been more true. Mm-hmm. So people feel more like testing. And so one of the things we recommend to people is you should test. You should test things, but you shouldn't do tests that make it harder to break up before you've gotten the result. And that's one of the problems with cohabitation, is it makes mm-hmm. it actually harder to break up. And people often don't see that. They're only thinking about the benefits. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of ways you can test. You know, you can talk about your worldviews. You can start talking about expectations, ideas about whether you want to have a family, whether you want to have kids. Those are great ways to test out the potential future of a relationship. None of those makes it harder to break up. Mm-hmm. Cohabitation is a test that makes it harder to drop the class if you fail the test. Mm-hmm.
And I want to just land on that for a couple minutes here, because I think that is huge. Through what you have written, as well as conversations I've had with Glenn Stanton, that was a big game changer for me, understanding that that kind of cohabitation making it harder to break up, because all of a sudden you start accumulating things together, or you start, you know, whether it's shared attachment, shared memories, shared stuff. Talk to us a little bit. Again, we need a little bit of a picture here, because I think some people will be like, oh no, don't worry. This is the age of the prenup. I got my stuff. He's got his stuff. But it's not true. The waters get muddied. What does that look like?
There's all kinds of things. There's a term that famous sociologist who's passed on now, Norval Glenn, said that was very similar to what we describe about inertia with cohabitation. He talked about premature entanglement. And so entanglement's a good word. Inertia's a good word. People start, and let's take cohabitation, because it really is the clearest single example of this. Start buying things together. Start combining playlists, you mm-hmm. know, musically. Mm-hmm. Maybe get a pet together. Maybe mm-hmm. sign a lease.
The phone plan you use.
Yeah, the phone plan. You know, so all these people
start,
and every one of those things seems small, but they're all accumulating what we call constraint commitment elements. My colleague Galena Rhodes and I, they're all accumulations of things that you would have to untangle. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people can relate to this more. There was a great piece written by a technology writer a couple years ago that I used in one of my blogs, where she was describing how she, you know, she loves Apple and iPhone and all this kind of stuff, but at times she feels constrained, and she might really like to try like Android or one of the other devices, but she's got so much invested now. There's so much inertia around my music's here, my accounts, all these devices talk to each other. It would be very hard to shift now. And that's how cohabitation becomes for a lot of people, to the point, now we can never tell the number, but we think some number of people marry somebody that they would not have married if they hadn't started living with them.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Just got too hard to break up.
And find out, yeah, after the fact. So that brings me to another thing I want to ask you about that you talk about quite a bit, and that is this cart before the horse issue of making a decision and then asking yourself after the fact, was that a good idea? And in fact, getting the information related to that decision
yes.
after the fact. What are you seeing as far as that a trend being a trend that's happening? What is that doing then to the people who realize that now they have made a decision, they've taken on the constraints or whatever, they're getting their information after the fact? What do they do with that? What are you seeing the results being?
It's a sad thing to watch, because what I think happens for a lot of people, and this relates to sexual relationships, even having a child together, living together, all these kind of transitions are very important life transitions, and people often don't see that those transitions can then constrain their options in the future. They change what their options are. And so what I think really happens for a lot of people, because they're not being really careful and they're not making decisions about what they're doing in their romantic life, is they're giving up options before they've made a choice.
Hmm. Okay. So we see in our culture, though, people, and I know you've talked about this, about some people who are in committed relationships, but they have not yet married. And a lot of it is a decision in your head of understanding, well, we're going to move towards marriage, or kind of wanting to, you know, play both sides. Brangelina being a great example.
Sure.
Finally decide to get married.
Yeah.
Years under their belt now. Kids under their belt. Now, of course, they're a celebrity couple. They can do whatever they want and have separate homes to not be in each other's hair or whatever. So, you know, we can't say they're exactly typical. But I see this with normal young adult couple. I mean, I see the ones that are living together for years because they are saving up to buy the ring, the exact ring and the exact wedding that they want. And so they would rather stay in that cohabiting relationship slash maybe engagement. Do you see ramifications of this? Is it just like a watering down of marriage in general so that that little leap is getting less and less? And what are the ultimate implications of that?
There's a paradox there because I think it is reflective of the watering down of marriage and the fact that people are comfortable now doing a lot of things where it used to be, you know, you're on this path and you should be getting married soon and all that. I also think, particularly for the well-off, you know, the people that have a lot of means, you can see people spending ever more ceremony. And there is some reason to believe that commitments are stronger, like with a lot of witnesses and things like that, because we feel more like we should follow through when we've really made a vow in front of a lot of people. So that's a good element of that. But some of the big rings and the giant expenditures and giant weddings, I think for some people, there is almost a feeling like, if we really invest that much in it, it'll give us a little extra insurance when it all feels so unsure. And one of the consequences for that that's really unfortunate is people sort of expect more and more lavish weddings financially. You can have a big wedding without it being lavish. It really affects the people on the low income side because they feel like, well, I can't afford that. We can't even like have a reception. And so you'll see a lot of avoidance of marriage among people that very much would like to be married, but they don't feel like they can do it in the way now that you're supposed to, which is kind of a tragedy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, well, I want to camp a little bit here as we finish up on the idea of, for all those of us that are sitting here very self-righteously and saying, well, I'm never going to cohabit. And then we're going to go all Beyonce and be like, if you like it, then you got to put a ring on it. but we are in dating relationships that are entirely ambiguous. You talk a lot about the ambiguity of breaking up and how that's become very muddied, certainly from, I'm sure, what you would reference as your own high school days or wherever, you know, of when you're done, you move on and all of that. What are you seeing? Why is there this sliding in relationships in general? Why are we so unwilling to define, you know, I think you even referenced the DTR, which it seems like if that happens in any relationship nowadays, someone's read some relationship books because that doesn't happen naturally. But how do we address a Christian crowd who may not be cohabiting, but certainly is probably making some questionable decisions as far as ultimately getting to marriage successfully?
I would say this. I think people, because of the sort of divorce revolution that we went through a couple decades ago, three decades ago actually now, all the different ways people started to think that marriage was the problem, that marriage was the problem with divorce, and if we just sort of avoid marriage or put off marriage or make things not so clear, we'll do better, which is really a naive sort of assumption. Relationships, if you will, are kind of the problem. Relationships are challenging, and they take commitment, and they take work. So a lot of people have embraced ambiguity because it feels safe. If I really press you to be clear about where this is going, maybe I'll scare you away. If I really press us to be clear about where this is going, maybe I'll scare myself away. Maybe I'll feel like, gosh, that means I'm getting close to locking this down with commitment. And then what'll I do? I'm not ready to kind of give up my options. Mm-hmm. But I think what people need to recognize that some ambiguity for a while is normal and healthy. I mean, if you're on like a third time with the person that you're interested in and you want to bring up how many kids you want to have together, that's pretty stupid. I mean, well, most of the time, I'm sure there's plenty of examples where it works out.
Yeah.
But if we're talking like you're getting pretty connected with each other and it's 6 months in and there's been no talk about anything, or, you know, as time goes on, ambiguity becomes really unsafe, because what ambiguity allows is for one person to really fool themselves about how committed their partner is. Mm-hmm. And many times one person's substantially more devoted to the relationship and into a future with this person than the other is. And they think the other is right where they're at, or maybe they're even afraid to find out that they're not, so they don't ask. But as time time goes on in that relationship, not having a talk or two that really clarifies whether you're on the same page about commitment and what could come from this relationship becomes really dangerous for your future, because now you're burning time that at best may be a bad investment, and at worst could really get you stuck somewhere that's not good for a long time.
Mm-hmm. So how can, you know, in light of that, what would you say to young adults about finding a, is there a sweet spot for that, the difference between the dance and romance and leaving space for that ambiguity versus when, in fact, I was talking to Martha, our producer, about this, and she was talking about just movies, sliding happens naturally and everything works out and it's all, you know, they're just, their feelings develop and it's all organic and whatever. But then you get into the Christian realm, and I think women especially feel we end up being the crazy people because we're pulling out assessments and all these books with 500 marriage questions you have to ask, and then the guys are all deer in the headlights and we look crazy. And so, but you need to have that information too.
Yeah.
And so how, I mean, it just seems so artificial to kind of find, I don't know, trying to find a good balance between the two. Should we try to find a balance, or?
I think it's hard to specify a real clear formula for any one person.
We all want the formula. Yeah.
But the guideline looks like this. And I actually love how you just expressed that, because I think sometimes Christians, we go the other way and we take too much confidence and deciding about everything and nailing down, hey, okay, now would you take this inventory and let's compare results and all. And you can go way too far on that, when a lot of that may not be how life would really go for the two of you. So I like to break it down into just the guideline. If you're a person in a relationship, you know you become really attached to the other. You can feel that. You would like the commitment to become clearer and you would like it to head toward marriage. If it's after a few months or what, I would feel comfortable saying a few months or something like that. If it's after 3 to 6 months or something and you're really feeling that strongly, it's time to actually get up the guts somewhere in there and try to initiate a conversation about where this is headed and see if the person's on the same page about the goals you have for life and what you're thinking about for lasting love, because you really need to know soon if that person's anywhere near the same page.
Yeah. All right. Well, great advice. Scott Stanley from the University of Denver, slidingversusdeciding.com. We will have that linked on the blog for this show. And we just appreciate you. Thanks for putting in all this time and effort for a generation that needs this insight. And we will do our best to disseminate that and take it down to the real world where we can as we're walking through that, Scott. So thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Lisa. I appreciate it.